Of course, one of the most fun things about being in space is being able to float. It's the most amazing thing. The next slide shows, at the end of our expedition, I wanted to show all the new modules. So you see Garrett and Oleg coming out of the European Columbus Science Module, and Sergei, Soyun, and Yuri coming out of the Japanese Logistics Module. They're traveling through the Harmony Module, which in our conga line, which we all added on. So we added on those three modules and increased the internal volume by 48%. Here we're flying through the U.S. Laboratory Module into the Unity Module, and you can see a sign on the right-hand side that says to the A/L, which is the airlock, and on the other side we now have Node 3 and the cupola, and then we've got four more modules past where the camera view is in the Russian segment. So it's really quite a huge station now, and of course, obviously, a lot of fun to float in space. I think that's it. Next slide. And for all the young people here, I wanted to say, you know, everybody always asks me, how did you become an astronaut? How do I become one? Well, my suggestion in life, whether or not you want to become an astronaut, is to, you know, set your goals high, higher than you think you can really achieve. Because you might actually surprise yourself. I know I did. I don't know about you, Bonnie. But it's also good to make sure that you're having fun along the way and really work hard to make those dreams come true.
Okay. Thank you. Sharing all those great videos and photos and things. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I have one more question, and then we're going to open up for questions from the audience as well. But I don't know whoever wants to answer first, but what is your perception of the future of the space program? I know there's a lot of things right now in politics and so forth, but what do you see as the next step?
Well, personally, I think, you know, exploration is, you know, in our blood, basically. You know, it's part of our chemistry, and we are going to explore. I think right now we are in a time of a lot of uncertainty. There are two bills out there. You know, Congress has, House has one, the Senate has another. Of course, they don't exactly line up, and neither of them lines up with what the president proposed. So I'm not really sure where we're going to end up in the short term, but I do know that exploration is what we need to be doing in the future.
Bonnie?
I concur completely with that, and I think we need to look at this century as a little different than last century when it was just the Soviet Union and the United States. You know, we currently have three nations that have the capability to launch people into orbit because the Chinese are there now getting ready for their fourth mission, and they're talking about space stations and going to the moon. India has talked about it. Several nations launched their own satellites. So getting out of the Earth's gravitational pull into orbit and into geosynchronous orbit is kind of part of the 21st century. And I think putting people out there into orbit and on the moon and beyond is going to be not just the purview of the United States, but other nations. And we need to look at ourselves as continuing to invest in that leadership, because it's not just about how we're perceived as leaders, but also investing here on the ground. I know some people have said, well, why did you waste all that money in space? And I remind them that we didn't spend a single cent in space. I know when I submitted my travel voucher, I got $1.42 for incidentals, but I didn't have any place to spend it in orbit, you know, and room and board supplied. It went into universities, it went into new technologies that we're still benefiting from. And I think exploration has been like that for thousands of years, and we need to continue that investment in leadership.
And maybe just continuing that just for a minute. I know you're involved with the museums and projects working with youth.
That's right. And one of the reasons I went to the museum is the board had asked me to help grow their educational programs K through 12 in science, technology, engineering, and math. And right now we reach about 120 to 140,000 kids in a five-state region. And we're launching distance ed now as well. And so we've got to inspire the young kids to have the tools. I know that Peggy and I probably took all the math and science we could get in school and loved it. But so many kids are opting out now, they don't have the tools to be able to contribute to these great visions. And we need them throughout the aerospace industry.
Well, now we're going to give you an opportunity to ask some questions. And I believe we have some folks out here with some microphones. So Judy and All right. If you would please maybe stand. And
hello. I'm just wondering what your grade point average was. Were you the top of your class? Because you must be both geniuses.
I have always said I'm not the sharpest tool in the shed. I have the privilege to work with some really, really talented, brilliant, in some cases, astronauts. I think each of us brings our own skills to the mix. I ended up graduating second in my class in high school, but it took a lot of extra work, so.
I graduated in the top part of my class as well, but I tell kids, I worked hard. I wasn't a natural genius, but I loved school, I loved homework. I was also a cheerleader for 4 years and in sports, so I mixed a lot of different things and took 2 years of Latin, which is really not a dead language, but but it really served me well in college. So you have to put the effort in, and as long as you aim high, and I didn't know it was a certain aim. A lot of my friends thought I was absolutely crazy, but that's what excited me. I picked all the things I could be, and the one thing that really drove me forward and excited me every day was the thought of going into space. And my hero was Flash Gordon, and he wasn't a real person, so.
2 years of Latin, huh?
Okay, over here on the right.
On your spacewalks, are you tethered?
Yeah, we're tethered all the time. We have it's a wire. It's about an eighth to a quarter of an inch wire that's in a reel, and it's attached to our spacesuit, and then we attach it to a station somewhere. And so we can move along the station, and then when we get to our work site, we usually attach a shorter tether to work at a specific location. And if you were let go of that shorter work tether, you would zip back to your original location, which you lose a lot of style points for that. It's not recommended.
All right.
Yeah, this is a question for either one of you. Maybe it'll take both of you to answer it. I always worry about space junk when you guys are up there working. Is there a one way, does everything rotate around the Earth the same direction, or do you have closing speeds out there?
We have definitely closing speeds, and when you're going 17,500 miles an hour, pretty much anything you run into is going to cause a problem. Anything much over of a quarter of an inch hole would be pretty devastating. The station could survive it for a little while, depending on where it hit. You would have time to get to your emergency vehicle or to shut the hatches. And we practice all that as part of our training to go through that. For instance, there was a close projection for an object that they were tracking from the ground today to the International Space Station. We have 6 people on orbit right now, and they were projecting a very close pass, and they watched it very closely for 3 orbits and decided it was okay, it was going to miss the station. But we have ground teams that can track the larger pieces of debris and, for instance, from satellites or other large pieces. Basically anything, you know, bigger than about this, they can track from the ground, which is pretty amazing.
And we really depend on the Air Force and Cheyenne Mountain to do that tracking and give us the alerts. And then we design the station to some statistical distribution of sizes so that we reduce the risk on it.
Another question?
Yes, after over 20 years, what was the problems associated with dating? Dating as in boy-girl dating?
On the shuttle? Or on the space station?
Well, never had any problems with that.
You didn't?
The question's about dating.
Seems like it'd be a little difficult with these cameras on you at all times.
It's well, unfortunately, my husband was on the ground. I didn't get to fly with him.
I see. Okay, thank you.
I know of one husband and wife team. I don't think they flew at the same time, and that's Hoot Gibson and his wife, Ray Seddon. And I understand that when their children were born, they referred to them as astrotots.
As a female pilot, and one of a very small minority among that league, especially here at Oshkosh, but in other places as well, do you see special challenges for women going forward, or what do you think the opportunities are in this day and age for women?
You know, when I was selected, it was the second class of women. 78 class had 6 women out of 35, and there were 2 out of 19 in my class. A lot of people don't realize that we've had over 40 women. How many total women? I mean, we've lost count. And it really is all about skill preparation. And one of the things I really enjoyed about NASA, because I came through as an engineer, I was in my 30s when I was selected, and loved engineering, worked for some great companies. And but when I came to NASA, it was probably the most equitable organization I ever worked in. If you could do the job, and particularly if you get on a crew, you have to pull your weight. It's just like flying. You do your job, and there's opportunities not just as an astronaut, but in support engineering and in the sciences across the board.
And, you know, I really feel lucky. I've been asked many times if I felt discriminated against or held back, and I really did not. Again, I've only worked at NASA, but I always felt like all I had to do was perform, do the job. And I think that if you go in with that attitude, that that's what you're there for, that you will succeed.
Okay. Another question?
All right. After 6 months in space, coming back to Earth, and besides gravity, what was the other striking thing that you re-encounter, basically?
Maybe the impact after that Soyuz landing. But the actually getting used to gravity again is probably the hardest part. Some people get motion sick when they go into orbit, just from the inner ear doesn't have any sense of what's up or down. For me, coming back to Earth and having that reestablished is very difficult. And for the first 24 hours, I really didn't want to be on Earth at all. I would have preferred to go back. But you adapt, get used to it, 2 or 3 days, and it's like, okay, I guess I can stay. I think we have a question right down here in the front. Can you come up and tell me what your question is? Was I scared when I went into space? Actually, you know, because I'd wanted to do it since I was about your height, maybe a little shorter even, I was so excited that I really wasn't scared. When I told you about that solar ray, that was probably the time I was most scared, because I was really worried about, you know, what we were going to do to fix it and if we would be able to fix it. And so that really made me scared. But I was never scared about going into space because it's something I always wanted to do.
Hi, could you please shed some light on how spacecraft are pressurized? I understand the process in airplanes, but you live in a shirt sleeve pressurized environment. If you could shed some light on that, please.
The question is just we're in a shirt sleeve environment, we're at sea level pressure. We have a thermostat so we can change the temperature. On my flights, we had the same challenges as a big family. The guys always wanted it cold. The women always wanted it hotter. you know, but it's very comfortable, and it's, you know, standard oxygen-nitrogen mix.
On board the space station, because it's a long-duration mission, on the shuttle flights, we just pump in more oxygen or nitrogen whenever we need it. And on board the space station, we're trying to, what we call, close the loop of the environmental system. So we have to have nitrogen tanks on board the station and have them resupplied. But we also take the carbon dioxide out of the air. The next piece of hardware that we're gonna have is gonna take that carbon dioxide and recombine it with the hydrogen and make water again. We're also collecting condensate, so the moisture in the breath that you breathe out or the sweat off of your body. Plus, also urine is recycled. So we're recollecting and reusing all that water as well to either make oxygen or to rehydrate our food. So isn't that a nice thought?
And this is our last question here in the front.
Thank you. Well, I would like to say, Peggy, thank you for bringing Bonnie and Peggy to us and everybody here. I've known at one time Bonnie. Peggy, a question on your landing. I got the word from Anush Ansari, what happened to her. Was yours about 6, 8, 9, 10 Gs?
Well, we went after the module enters the atmosphere, actually just before, The Soyuz space capsule divides into three parts, and then only one section re-enters. And because one out of five of our hooks didn't separate, we re-entered in a non-aerodynamic orientation. So the two pieces were banging off at each other, and we were flopping around, going different directions, and doing the lawn dart imitation as opposed to a normal re-entry with the heat on the heat shield. And eventually the bolt melted, and we then became aerodynamic, but the sensors, the accelerometers, were so far off scale that the automated system said, no longer can I fly you, but it says the accelerometers are so bad you can't fly you. And so we downmoded into what's called a ballistic re-entry. And normally, a normal re-entry is around 4.5 Gs. It peaks for a couple of minutes at that and then comes down and then goes back up to 2.5 and then comes down again. On our re-entry, because we came in ballistic, it immediately went up to 8 Gs, held there for a while, and the second peak was around 4.5 Gs. And then we came down. We were under the chutes, same as everybody else at that point in terms of speed and landing. And so the actual impact with the ground is the same. It was just the 8 Gs in the re-entry profile that was different.
And did you have the rockets help stop?
Yeah, the rockets worked, but because we had so much wind underneath the chutes, the capsule sits, and then 0.8 meters off the ground, it has what's called soft landing engines fire. And if there's no wind, that works really well. It was a very windy day for us, and so we were swinging out to the side, and so the soft landing engines actually spun us, and you know, we rolled a few times and bounced 15 meters or so. It was pretty sporty.
Thank you. You all don't know what a great this is, a great situation. Thank you.
Well, and actually, I know we've got to go, but if you play the STS-132 fly around while we're, you know, finishing up, just the video of that, just to see how incredible this thing is that we have in low Earth orbit. And if you guys go to www.spaceflight.com, you can look up when the space station's flying over your city. And you can actually see it either early morning or in the evening at dusk and actually see it flying over. But it's an incredible, incredible vehicle.
Thank you.
Thank you both of you for being here tonight and sharing your experiences with us.